This episode is brought to you by Levo. Simple, potent, at-home herbal infusions at the push of a button. Learn more at levooil.com and feed your enthusiasm. That's levooil.com.
Hey there, and welcome to the Feed Feed podcast. I am your guest host this week, Alexa Santos. I am a food editor at the actual Feed Feed, the world's largest crowdsourced food publication and social media community, serving as your daily source for what to cook, bake, eat, and drink. On this season of the Feed Feed podcast, we are doing a special series called What's on Your Table. Each episode, I will be taking a look at a specific country, region, or people and talking to a few members of the Feed Feed community about the food, recipes, ingredients, and flavors that make up the dishes that are always on their tables. Today, we are spotlighting Black women in food and entertainment, and I'm joined by two amazing guests who I admire oh so much. We have Lonnie Halliday, a Brooklyn-based food artist, baker, mom, founder, and owner of Brutus Bake Shop, a gluten-free cake and pastry company. Lonnie's work, much like her own story, is all about trial and error, learning from mistakes, leading with love, and baking for yourself. From London to New York, Lonnie has shared her craft as a gluten-intolerant, professionally trained pastry chef with lovers of baked goods around the world. Her creations captivate the eye, speak to the soul, and celebrate the messiness of life. Lonnie Halliday redefines what it means to be a traditional baker, paving the way for a new generation that is unafraid to bake outside the lines. She is recognized by leaders in food and fashion alike, including InStyle, Vogue, and most recently as the cover star of Cherry Bomb. Amazing. I'm also joined by Mako Nlovu. Mako is an on-air host, entertainment correspondent, event host, and social media influencer. A multi-talented media personality, Mako has lent her talents to various outlets and stages, including stints as a lifestyle expert for The Wendy Williams Show, an acclaimed on-air host of Essence Now, guest host of People Now, correspondent for BET International, and MC of various prestigious galas and panels. Mako currently co-hosts Today's Deals Live, Amazon's daily shopping show. The Zimbabwe-born tastemaker has made a name for herself as the go-to woman for all things global entertainment and culture. Mako and Lonnie, welcome to the Feed Feed podcast.
Wow. Thanks for having
me. That was so good. Oh my gosh. Okay. All right.
You guys are very impressive. I was like getting excited as I was reading. Like, wow, look at these.
Job.
Look at these accolades. Thank you so much.
Yeah,
well,
Mako, it's a pleasure to meet you.
Yes. Mako, let's start with you. So I know you were born in Zimbabwe and you came to the US, but I have no idea. Tell me, how old were you when you came? What was that whole process like? And yeah, this is kind of your early childhood story. So please tell me about that.
It is. And it's so great because it was just yesterday. So I can just vividly recall it. I'm totally lying. I've been in the US for over 25 years. I came here when I was 9. And you know, it was so interesting what I thought the US was going to be versus what it was. So to give you context, I grew up in Zimbabwe. I grew up in suburbia. I know that's like a huge surprise, maybe to some people, because the idea that they have of Africa is not like a lot of suburbs and people living in cities. But yeah, that's exactly what goes down. So I grew up in suburbs, and my first taste of American culture was like Dallas and Falcon Crest and the Dolly Parton show. So that's what I thought America was going to be. And then when I got here and we moved to Brooklyn in the 90s, it was a bit different. And so that was like a huge shift for me. But
just a little bit different than Dolly Parton.
Yes. You can imagine when I rolled up to third grade at my elementary school, PS44. And I had on my cowboy boots, my cowboy hat, my jeans tucked into my cowboy boots, and my country shirt. The kids were like, "What is wrong with her? Why does she sound like that?" So it was good times.
Oh my god!
Wow.
That is hilarious.
I can relate. I have a very similar story. I'm loving this, Mako. This is beautiful.
Oh yeah, I can't wait to hear it. I'm like, all immigrants have this story.
Yeah, I guess so. So Lonnie was born, you were born in London, or what was your situation?
No, I was actually born in Hawaii. And so I'm from the States, but very similarly, I had never been to the mainland. And I didn't know what to expect when I moved here. I was similarly aged. I was 10. I moved to just a little suburb outside of Portland, Oregon. And I'd never experienced the cold. I probably had a pair of closed-toed shoes growing up. I don't remember that. Mm-hmm. I'd never owned a coat. And come 1st September, you know, first day at the school bus in fifth grade, I showed up to school in a snowsuit. I was freezing, and it was just like September, you know.
It was probably like 60 degrees.
Yeah, it was probably like 65 degrees and like a little bit humid in the morning, because it's, you know, it's like wet there in the Pacific Northwest. Yeah. And I was just like, you guys, how are you not? Everyone was just in like jeans and a sweater, or like, you know, like a sweatshirt. And I was just like, I'm so cold. I was in a sweatsuit, or a snowsuit rather.
Oh,
and people were just like, what is up with you?
But you were warm. You were warm.
I was
though,
not
right?
warm enough. No. Still not warm enough.
Oh, wow.
Well, you've come a long way. As far as style and ability to deal with the winter, I can imagine. So Lonnie, tell me a little bit about, I mean, you said you were born in Hawaii. What was kind of like some of the traditional dishes that your family was making at home? I know you were, and when were you in London during all of that? So I'm trying to get the timeline right. And what kind of cuisine did you grow up with, really?
Sure. I mean, I was really, really lucky in the sense of, when I lived in Hawaii, so Hawaii really is, you know, everyone sort of thinks as the United States is like the melting pot, right? And Hawaii really is that. And I grew up going to Baptist church as a kid, and every Sunday we would have a potluck. And in my church, I mean, it was just like a Benetton ad. It was people from every possible nation you could imagine. We had like Japanese folks and Filipino folks and white folks and black folks. And I didn't know any families also that weren't interracial families. I didn't know that interracial families weren't literally what everyone was until I was like 10. Like I do not recall any family that I knew that had like two white parents or two black parents. Actually, no, I think one kid in the fourth grade came, and he was so strange because he was like white, and both of his parents were white. And I was like, whoa, that's weird. But I, you know, it was like only something that like I barely even clocked, because it was so other. Like I didn't even really fully have the language to be like, something's weird here. But anyway, so I definitely grew up. I mean, my mom is South Brooklyn Italian, and my dad is a black man from Alabama. And, you know, both of my parents are tremendous cooks, and everyone, I mean, I ate everything growing up. It was like lumpia, which is a traditional Filipino thing, and like curried chicken wings and fried chicken and lasagna. Mm-hmm. But it was like all the things from all the places every week. And so this idea of like, one kind of thing. I mean, my mom still to this day makes lumpia every Christmas. It's like a traditional Christmas food. So,
and she's Italian.
she actually grew up near where I live now in Brooklyn. Oh. My parents got married in Prospect Park, and
full circle.
She can't understand why I live here. but you know, it's I was very, very fortunate to have this sort of like full spectrum exposure from a very young age of like all these different tastes and flavors. And, you know, I grew up eating like at the like Manapua trucks in Hawaii, and like Hawaiian shave ice, and like lots of traditional Hawaiian things as well. So lots of different things.
That is so cool. And it's so fascinating to hear about kind of the dichotomy between what you considered normal and what probably, you know, mainland American young children would consider normal. So that is really, really cool to hear about. Mako, what was your kind of culinary situation when you were growing up as kind of an immigrant here. I feel like I'm imagining that scene from My Big Fat Greek Wedding when she brings the moussaka to school and they're all like, what is that?
Oh, yeah. There were tons, totally. That happened several times during me growing up here in the U.S. But what's so interesting is as Lonnie's talking, I'm like, oh, my gosh, I don't think I've ever had any like kind of Hawaiian food. I think the only thing, and this is so bad, it's probably not even really Hawaiian, the Hawaiian food rolls that they have that are so sweet, those things are dangerous. But that's the closest thing that I've ever had. And I don't even think that's Hawaiian, is it? It's not,
you
right?
Hawaiian sweet rolls?
Yeah.
Like the bread? Oh, no, yeah.
The bread.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That is?
I mean, the stuff you get at the grocery store, like that King David, like.
Yes.
I mean, that might Hawaiian King bread?
Oh, yes,
it is, but like, you know, it's like just like
Dame that's like saying Taco are... Bell is Mexican food.
It's Mexican. Well, that's what Mexican I feel like I just said. I committed like, the cardinal sin.
I mean, I don't think that like that specific thing, but it's like it's all about kind of like where you're coming from, though, right? So like, wouldn't you say that like Murray's potato rolls are like a very classically like East Coast thing? Right, like you would have like a lobster roll from Maine, you would have on like whatever, like a store bought thing. Like that's like kind of how American it is. That's how the states are. Like just like there are some like processed items that sort of get like entrenched through this kind of like colonization of food and like all like colonization touches everything. And so I mean, I think that like when you're talking about like the day to day, la gente, like. Something that I really associate with growing up in Hawaii is like Spam and like the history of that, you know, because like you would go to the Manapua trucks, which is like these like traditional, like Manapua is like it's like bao buns, it's like a steam, it's like a bread,
it's steamed, and it has like, I love that filling.
So typically like meat, like char siu pork or you know, Spam or chicken less often, but I remember the like hot pink like char siu pork in the middle of these steamed buns, but like Spam wasn't uncommon, but Spam was like a U.S. military food that sort of like colonized it. But there are traditional Hawaiian foods like things like poi and taro and you know, things like that so I don't know, it's like it all kind of is a matter of like how do you process and view like what is traditional? Is something traditional from, you know, like from my perspective of me growing up as a kid in the 80s, or are you talking about something that goes back through like pre-colonization? And like, I think that like when you're talking about people's culinary perspectives, that it's not like pretty, but it's not invalid, if you get what
I get it. I get it. That is very interesting. Okay.
Isn't Lonnie so like eloquent and like she really gets you to think about things. Like she's very deep. It's so, I love talking to her.
No,
it's
but
so
I love
fascinating.
It. Now, see, now I'm adding more stuff onto my list. Okay, so sorry to have us go on that.
Yes. We got an education.
Right? Okay, so to answer your question, the question was, what was my food experience back home or
growing up? Just like, yeah, I mean, what were some of your, you know, your early food memories and like the type of food that your family was preparing, you know, that you were kind of used to eating growing up?
Absolutely. So we have this thing, we call it istrana. It's essentially cornmeal. So think of cornmeal in like the powder format, the flour format that you see it in the stores right now. So we take that, we add water, you take it into sort of the porridge stage, and then you keep adding more cornmeal, and then it becomes this soft yet thick consistency. And so we use that, and we eat that as our staple, as our rice, and then you eat it with other vegetables or you eat it with meat. So that was like my earliest memory growing up was eating istrana. It's like something that we would have for breakfast, not for breakfast, for porridge. We would have porridge for breakfast, and then we would have istrana for lunch, and then we would also have it for dinner. So for lunch, you probably wouldn't want to have meat or something that's heavy, so you can mix it with some milk. Or for dinner, you could have, like I said, the vegetables, different types of vegetables. We're talking mixed vegetables, or you can have collard greens, or you can have cabbage and a side of meat. And the meat could be anything from beef to stewed chicken to fish to pork to whatever you name it. So that was sort of what we used to eat back home. And then when we came to the US, we kind of had to adapt, right? So the same quality of estrella or cornmeal that we would get back home, we weren't able to get here. So we had to go out to, you know, the Spanish supermarkets and the different sort of, I don't want to call them ethnic places, but the stores that cater
specialty to stores.
Specialty stores, yeah. That cater to immigrants from other countries. And then we started, you know, finding the cornmeal and creating it and cooking at home. And that's just something that's always been a constant. Like if you go to my mom's house in Indiana, I try to tell her you can't eat it every single day. I don't think it's good for you every single day, but she cooks this challa at least 3 times a week. And it's just a bonding experience with my friends that are from America, introducing them to my culture, the way that we cook it. You know, it's a very interesting process. I kind of truncated it, but the process is really interesting, the way that you get it to kind of like really get hot, and it kind of, it's almost like a little volcano in there. And so it's very, very interesting the way that we cook it. So that's like my earliest food memory, and that's where a lot of memories around food are built.
That's amazing. Well, that'll be our next task, Mako, is for you to make that for me, because that sounds so cool, and I'm always so fascinated to learn about how different cultures kind of prepare their staple dishes. So that's up next.
Yes.
It sounds like polenta. It sounds like.
It is. Mm-hmm. So it's similar to polenta, but I think polenta is a little bit softer. This is a little bit firmer. Mm-hmm. It's not quite as soft. So I think polenta is more almost like porridge, right? Like a thicker version
sometimes,
of porridge.
It depends on how you prepare it. Sometimes you can prepare polenta so that it's sliceable.
Mm-hmm. That's what it is. It's like sliceable like that. And of course you use your hands to eat it. I mean, some people use forks, but you know, we kind of judge that. You can eat it however you want, but I think the hand, you really get the full experience when you use your hands to eat it.
Yeah. So do you eat
it at room temperature? Or you eat it hot? Okay.
Because it's so hot when you cook it. So you have to let it kind of cool down for a little bit. And then you eat it at room temperature. And when it gets cold, it kind of sticks onto the bottom of the pot. So what we do is we kind of like, we scoop it up and put it in aluminum foil so it maintains its shape. And then it maintains its warmth as well. And then everyone can just kind of pick up the aluminum foil, put it on the plate, and eat it with whatever we're serving.
Oh,
wow. Well, we're learning so much. I love it. Lonnie, tell us, I know you have quite a story involving your foray into baking and, you know, being gluten intolerant. And I'm sure that was kind of a hurdle for you to get over, you know, being in the culinary world and, you know, having so many foods that you couldn't eat, unfortunately. So tell us kind of your story with baking and starting your business. And I know a lot of your, you know, specialty items are very kind of unique, and you have a really cool perspective on baking and, you know, culinary endeavors in general. So I'd love to hear about that.
Oh yeah. I mean, wow, that's a heck of an intro. Thank you. Yeah. I mean, I guess I've kind of just been, you know, doing my own thing for basically my whole life. Nice. I'm really kind of like a super social lone wolf. Oh. And I kind of, you know, I apprenticed as a baker when I was a really young person, about 19. And I learned a great deal from this gentleman who has passed away. But he taught me so, so much. And I developed a wheat allergy working as a baker. And I had to stop eating wheat. And at the time I was a vegetarian and I was consuming a lot of like ersatz meat products, like wheat, gluten based seitan and things like that. And so I was consuming a great deal of wheat protein, and I was coming in contact with it physically. And I think it was just sort of this combination of environmental exposure and genetic predisposition. I got a wheat allergy. I stopped eating wheat. And I kind of just went from there. I kind of had to leave the baking role. I took a little jog and studied holistic medicine and like herbs and this sort of holistic take on how food and herbs can be really health supportive. And I just really immersed myself in that, learned a lot about that. And when I moved to New York, I got a job working at a gluten-free bakery called, it was called Baby Cakes at the time. It's called Erin McKenna's Bakery now. It was downtown on Broome Street. And she was an amazing mentor. She's still an amazing mentor and friend and someone I can reach out to. She's a tremendous businesswoman and a really wonderful person. I left the workforce for about 6 years. I became a mom. I had a kid. Vets, Alexa, where I moved to London. So when I had my first kid, right. So I had a kid and when I was 26. And then my husband at the time and I moved to the UK for about 4 years. I had another kid, moved back stateside. We were there for about 4 years, moved back stateside and kind of bopped around a little bit. Went to pastry school in like 2013 into 2014, moved back to New York, and I've kind of just been working my butt off ever since. I was a kitchen manager at Ovenly for a while and ran their cake program. I started freelancing while I was working there and kind of just kept going, kept putting one foot in front of the other from there. And all the while, I always baked. I always baked gluten-free at home. I focused my time. Like every time I would go to the grocery store, I would just buy like gluten-free ingredients and then just try and test. There was some resources at the time, but it really was a lot of trial and error. And I had to really familiarize myself with the different kinds of flours that were available. I kept, you know, notes all the time when I would experiment with different recipes. And then, you know, these gluten-free flour blends started coming onto the market. And yeah. In the UK, they have quite a bit more of those things. They're really keyed into the gluten-free thing. I mean, you can get bread on prescription at the pharmacy. If you're diagnosed as celiac, you can, and it's really good too. I had a friend who lived down the block and her husband was celiac and I'd go over for like tea and hang out with the kids and that. And she would make me like tea and toast. And she'd be like, oh, you can have some of Steve's bread. He doesn't barely eat it anyway. And I'd be like, what is this? It's really good. She'd be like, oh, we get it at the pharmacy. He gets bread on prescription. And I'm like, seriously? She's like, yeah, he's gluten-free. And, you know, the NHS just gives it him as a prescription. So, wow. Yeah. So they just, you know, there's lots of like free from stuff in all the grocery stores there. And I really just kind of got into it. It gave me this pathway of like, okay, you can make gluten-free puff pastry. That is something that exists. You can make gluten-free croissants if you want to keep trying. And I just kind of, I had time. I was a total like total housewife. I mean, I like made baby food and washed diapers and, my husband had this like high flying job as a record company CEO. And I just was like at home with old babies. So I just spent a lot of time just honing my craft and studying. I'm autodidactic very much. And I just kept going and kept going.
Amazing. And your brick and mortar is a recent foray, correct?
Yeah, so it's kind of a little bit confusing, I think, so for people. Thank you.
Yes, congratulations. I was so excited to see that.
Thank you so much. It's kind of a weird setup. And I think that people kind of are like, wait, so what is it? So I share my retail space with another person. So there's a restaurant in Brooklyn in Crown Heights on Bedford and Sterling Ave, 724 Sterling Ave. It's called Ursula.
Yes.
And it's a New Mexican restaurant run by and owned by a gentleman named Eric C. And I essentially wholesale to him. We'll just kind of frame it like that because people can kind of get. And I have basically a whole shelf, dedicated shelf in the pastry case, and I can kind of just do whatever I want. And I send over pastry every day and you can get all your Brutus Bake Shop baked goods there. I just today launched Brutus Bake Shop online. So now we ship nationally and everyone can get all their beautiful Brutus Bake Shop goodies at LonnieHalliday.com/Brutus Bake Shop. That's the format. That's
amazing.
The format.
No, I was going to ask you about, you know, obviously a lot of our listeners aren't in the, you know, New York City area. So the fact that you are able to ship nationwide is a huge accomplishment and a congratulations on that. I know that is no small feat, but also very exciting for people who want to access your products that aren't in the area. So very, very cool. And I think that's really, you know, what you're doing is serving that the audience of people who, you know, want specialty baked goods that are gluten-free and delicious. And wow, very exciting.
Yeah, and everything is, the kitchen is gluten-free. So I'm gluten-free, and for the longest time I've served, you know, celiac populations and things, and I knew that it's always been a goal to be able to produce in a kitchen that's gluten-free, that, you know, we don't produce, it's not a shared space. So, you know, we really can cater to the folks. I mean, I'm just wheat allergic. I'm not celiac.
Right.
So, but, you know, to be able to provide that space, it really is like, it feels like very much leveling up for what we can offer people, for sure.
Amazing. So, Mako, my next question is for you. As kind of an entertainment guru, fashionista, all kinds of things, you know, how, you know, your culture, of course, you know, growing up in Zimbabwe, I'm sure, is a huge part of, you know, your day to day. And I just want to talk about, you know, how you weave that into your career as, you know, an on-air correspondent and, you know, fashion expert and lifestyle expert, and just want to kind of talk about the way that you weave your culture into your career.
Absolutely. First of all, I can't wait to order some of those gluten-free pastries now that I know that they're available online. Like, dang, I have to get in an Uber and go all the way to the other part of Brooklyn. But now, okay.
It's going down.
It's going down. Now, my husband and I love pastries.
COVID
tea. Oh, yes. Oh, my gosh. It's so good. Okay. So how do I weave my culture? Well, I think we have to look at where I started in terms of my entertainment career. When I first started out, people from back home were honestly some of my biggest supporters, right? So they would really cheer me on. They would plug me into other opportunities. So for instance, when I was here living in New York, I'm very much in tune with what's happening back home. So I would write for this blog called Just Curious at the time. It's no longer around, but it was one of the biggest entertainment blogs in South Africa. They had an opportunity to cover the red carpet awards for the MTV awards in LA. And they called me up and they were like, listen, we want you to do this and, you know, cover the awards. And my perspective is from the first time that I was on that stage, oh, not on the stage, haven't been on the MTV stage yet, but on the red carpet, was to make sure that I always represent myself and I represent my culture. And ultimately, I try to represent the continent. I know that the continent is not a country, but I really try and put that to be the first thing that I want people to see when they meet me. And what does that look like? That looks like when I go out on the carpet or if I'm interviewing a celebrity, I try and get little nuggets for that audience member who might be back home or who might be in the diaspora, who you know, wants to have that sense of, okay, this girl is the girl next door. She's sharing some information about who we are, or she's asking the question that I've always wanted to know about this particular celebrity, you know, as a person who's from back home. So that's one of the ways that I do that. But if I'm like the video that I just did, I think you saw this on my Instagram page.
Yes.
As I'm going in my career and doing the lifestyle thing, I have so many talents and so many things that I'm passionate about. Like, entertainment is one big pillar in my life. I love entertainment and I love all kind of spectrums of entertainment, whether it's like Hollywood or African entertainment or, you know, K-pop, whatever it is, I love global entertainment culture. But another pillar, another passion point for me is creating my own content, right? I think those things can exist can exist at the same time.
Definitely.
And one of the things that I want to do is share the food that we eat and share our culture and share inspirational stories. So my goal really is to do both, right? To work in spaces where I can represent for people back home, but I can also share my culture with new ears, new people that are hearing it or seeing it for the first time, but also give people a sense of like nostalgia, people that might be in the diaspora, to let them know that we also have this really cool culture that we're brewing here, but we're still kind of connected to home. So I hope that makes sense, but that's essentially how I try to bring my culture forward in everything I do.
No, that is a fantastic answer. And I've decided that the title of your memoir is going to be the Zimbabwean Girl Next Door. So
I love that. Right now.
Yeah, you said that. I was like, oh my gosh, that's amazing. I love that. No, and that's super cool, especially when you are, you know, I think that a lot of people have, you know, misconceptions or haven't traveled to Africa or don't know, you know, the variances between the different countries there. And I think that you kind of putting a spotlight on the different cultures that are from within the continent and kind of bringing light to those voices is an amazing thing to do. And we are all grateful for the education, Mako.
It's my life's work. And I'll tell you, in the very beginning, I used to get super annoyed, right? Because I would get like really silly questions like, you know, were you guys wearing clothes in Africa? How did you get here? Who's the president of Africa? So stuff like that used to really get under my skin. But then now, you know, after living here for so long, I understand that for the most part, for some people, it is just purely ignorance. And they're just going to continue to try to perpetuate those stereotypes. But there are some people that this is an opportunity to learn. And this is an opportunity to show people a completely different lens of what they view African culture, Southern African culture, specifically Zimbabwean culture, to be. It's so varied and diverse. I love what Lani said earlier in terms of the fact that we were colonized by the British, right? Yeah. So a lot of our food choices are kind of informed by the British. Like when I say tea and scones, like I mean that we have tea and scones, you know, which is a very British thing. But because we were colonized, we do a lot of those things. You know, we a lot of that influence is still felt today. But our culture is just so vast. We have our own Zimbabwean culture. So it's truly is an honor to get to share that with people. And even my name, we were talking about my name before this call.
Yes.
You know, that's a way that I weave my culture into my job is just like just by saying my name, it becomes a conversation starter.
Can you pronounce it correctly for us? Because I'm sure I didn't do that great of a job.
You actually did great. So what I've determined now is that there's going to be an American way to say it. And there's going to be the way to say it from back home. Because the NDL make a sound together, and that sound is so it's actually Ndlovu. Exactly, you can do it if we had time,
we could work on
but
it.
But honestly, I think there's probably one or two people that have actually been able to say my name correctly, so I'm like, you know what, you know,
it's can you say the whole thing, your first and last name?
Yeah, so my first name is Makosazana, right? Okay. Which means an unmarried princess. Ooh. And my last name means Ndlovu. My last name is Ndlovu, which coincidentally means elephant. We were grouped by, our tribes were grouped by, our clan names were grouped by animals. So unmarried princess elephant is
awesome. Oh my gosh, I never knew that about you. I'm so happy I asked. That's such a fun little like tidbit. And yes, you are a princess, married or unmarried.
Exactly.
You want to know something, Mako? Firstly, I was completely engrossed listening to you, and the thread I heard through all of that was joy and service. And it sounds like joy and service are just all over everything that you do. And I just absolutely love that. And that's definitely a thread that weaves through what I do as well. And I can totally relate. And my full name is actually Noheilani is my first name. It's a Hawaiian name. It actually means
that is beautiful.
Heavenly princess.
Heavenly princess, you said?
Yes. Yes.
Oh my God.
Look at these princesses!
I have two princesses.
Yes,
dang, this is beautiful.
Oh my gosh, wow. That's so cool.
That's such a beautiful name.
That is really, really beautiful. I'm so happy that I know both of your full names now. I feel like I've gotten to a new level.
Right. Yes. Untapped a new level here.
Amazing.
Everyone's called me Lonnie since I was a kid, except for my father. He calls me Noheya. But everyone else calls me Lani. Lani is like a very common, like it's part of a compound name. So it's like you get lots of Kailani and Pualani and Leilani. And my name is Noheilani. You don't frequently hear Lani just on its own.
Yeah.
But yeah, wow.
Good to know.
This episode is brought to you by Levo, the world's most intelligent at-home infuser. It's super easy to use to make infusions for cooking, candies, cosmetics, and herbal medicines. When the box showed up, I was excited to try it out as I've heard good things about the machine. It looks like a space-age coffee maker on the counter, and having it out makes me want to infuse everything. I've got plans for the hot peppers on my counter and the sage I picked from the garden before the first freeze last week, along with some other choice herbs and spices. I think everyone on my list is going to get infused oils this year. So far, I've used it for cannabis, basil, and orange peel infused oils and butter. The machine even has dry and activate functions for the highest potency and stability in your infusions, and you can connect through Wi-Fi to track your progress and record your recipes and share with the Levo community. Learn more at levooil.com. That's levooil.com.
Well, Lonnie, I meant to ask you before, but I would love for you to kind of rattle off some of your creations. I know your Pop-Tarts are incredibly popular and they're very like, so Lonnie's dishes are all very like, this isn't just like strawberry shortcake. Like these are very like cool, flavorful creations. So I'd love to hear about those. And then also if you could kind of talk about, you know, we have to talk about, you know, COVID impacts and obviously starting a business and being a small business owner during this time has been dicey. So those are the two things that I would love you to touch on if you don't mind.
No, yeah, that's great. I'll tell you what my current menu is. At the moment online, you can order two different kinds of Pop-Tarts. I've got a guava passion fruit Pop-Tart, which is a guava filling and a passion fruit glaze. The dough that I use, the recipe I created for that, everything I do is gluten-free. A lot of what I do is vegan. That is a gluten-free vegan guava passion fruit Pop-Tart. It's got these super fun sprinkles on top.
AKA a miracle. A gluten-free vegan guava passion fruit Pop-Tart.
I meditated on that pie dough. I manifested that in my mind's eye for a very long time.
Oh my gosh.
And the chocolate maple cardamom Pop-Tart is the other Pop-Tart that's available. Also vegan. I make it with Rocca chocolate, which is this very high-end, beautiful chocolate that I get in Red Hook, Brooklyn. It is chocolate, a couple different kinds of Rocca chocolate, cardamom, maple syrup, and also Lush, also vegan, also gluten-free. Ooh. I've got the miso chocolate chip cookie, which is probably my best-selling thing. It is also gluten-free, vegan, soy-free. It is made with chickpea miso. It's like rich and salty with some Maldon sea salt on top, and they're gigantic cookies. And I would say the last thing that you can get at the moment on my website is the spiced ginger molasses cookies. And they're just like these beautiful, gigantic, as big as your face. Like they've got turbinado sugar on them. They're super crinkly and craggy and moist and in the middle and crispy on the edges and nice and spicy. And so those are my current.
My mouth is watering.
Yeah. So when she gets
that last one.
When she gets bought out, she's about to get two very large orders. It's me and Mako.
Yes, right, totally.
And then what was the other part of the question? I got really wrapped up in that.
No, I was very wrapped up too. I was like, ooh. Yes, I was wondering about kind of like being a small business owner during COVID.
Yeah, so I mean, I was doing my thing freelancing before the shutdown. I was renting space in from Eric C. He shut his last company down called The Awkward Scone. It was in Bushwick on like Willoughby and Broadway in Brooklyn. And I was renting space from him, just freelancing, making cakes. I had a catering company doing like event production in the city for a long time. And then as soon as the virus shut, I was actually working on this super beautiful, like super successful, like sold out pop-up dinner series at the Maid Hotel in the city. And it was a communal eating experience. So we definitely shut that down at the beginning of COVID.
Oh.
And we just had to pivot.
Yeah, that was like step one.
On, I really just worked on sort of mutual aid stuff. I didn't know what to do. And service has always been a really big part of my life. And, you know, we were on food stamps when I was a kid. We ate with, I don't know if you're familiar with the Gleaners in this country. They're basically like recapturing citizens where they sort of like, if like there's a bunch of produce at a grocery store, you know, they'll go and get it and collect it and kind of distribute it to people in their communities. So working in service around food and food equity and food sovereignty to a degree has always kind of been part of what I do. And just service in general, service. I worked at Planned Parenthood for the longest. And we kind of just like switched immediately into this mode of service. And we worked with an organization called FIG here in Brooklyn. That's just like a community-led organization around feeding people. So we were packing grocery bags and cooking food and sending those out every week. We kind of just did that for the longest. And we didn't really know what we were going to do. I did that for about 3 months straight, like not really knowing what was going to come next. And then the place that I was working out of ended up closing, not because of COVID, but because they were sort of limping along. The business was okay, but the business partners decided to end at their business. And so I kind of just had to think about what was next. And basically, Eric C. and I were going to open a place and share space. And he opened Ursula. And in about a week, we realized that just wasn't going to be feasible. The place is way too small. We were both way too big in terms of like what we needed to do. And the place didn't have the bandwidth to hold us. And I just sort of went, I'm just going to get a production space and sell stuff online. Yeah. And within a few weeks, I moved in. It was really funny. I also like suffer really much from like anxiety. I've had anxiety attacks and my, you know, all these things. And it was really funny. It was a really big deal for me to sign the lease on this thing. And my friend was like, you know, I'm so proud of you. Like, you did that. And like, that's amazing. Like, congratulations. And he was like, were you afraid? And I was like, no.
Wow.
My friend broke up with me the week I signed the lease of this place. And I was so sad and emotionally depleted that I was like, there's no bandwidth to be sad.
Wow.
or like scared or fearful. Like, I just glossed over the part where I was like, freaked out about signing the lease. I was just like, oh, it's fine. I'll just do that. And I just like moved in here, like under, you know, like a mask full of tears and the whole nine yards. And I've just been like putting one foot in front of the other and just being like, sorry, everyone. Like, thanks for bearing with.
But time for you to kill it.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
it's the time.
You know, but really being with, you know, being with reality. The reality is that the world has changed. Mm-hmm. And the reality is that opportunities have changed. And the reality is that my industry has been so deeply impacted. We don't know, you know, I've known so many people who've lost their restaurants, who've lost their livelihoods, who don't know what's coming next. I mean, the industry has been incredibly impacted. I mean, yeah. I can't understate it. And to be able to move and pivot and, you know, for the longest, I just lamented my journey. You know, for the longest, when I was at home, I would think, oh, my peers are doing all these things. And, you know,
yeah,
I my career is on hold. And, you know, I felt very much when I got back into the workforce that I had to scramble to catch up. And I had a really hard time just accepting that my time would unfold in my time. And, you know, just that like my higher powers plan for me would unfold as it should. And, you know, being in this moment where I get to see, to be in bloom inside of this moment has been such a blessing, multitude of blessings, not least of all, because I get to see that I get to just trust my path and that's well and good. And there's no need to compare, or there's no need to worry, or there's no need. One just must keep putting one's foot in front of the other and doing what they need to do. And I mean, I also like work my ass off.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
I'm the person who will work, you know, 14, 16 hour days.
Oh my gosh.
For weeks on end. You know, it's not as if I just sort of Pollyanna'd my way into where I am at this moment. I work very, very hard. I've been blessed with a physical constitution that allows me to just work in that way. And
well, that's amazing advice for everybody. I mean, it's I think everybody can relate to what you explained about comparing yourself to others during this time and feeling like your momentum and, you know, path is on hold based on the state of the world, and just feeling like, you know, you are going to have to play so much catch up. So it's, I think that advice really holds true for, you know, anybody in whatever industry you're in. And it's really inspiring to hear kind of how you got through that. And I just feel like we can all do it now. I'm like, we're good to go. Like, Lonnie's words of inspiration. I'm ready. Mako, I kind of have the same question for you, because obviously being an entertainment correspondent, turning all of that into remote has got to be, I mean, we talked about this a bit earlier, a very in-depth and a bit of a crazy process. So give us a little taste of what your life is as an on-air correspondent from home.
Yeah, my life is crazy, but I absolutely love it. I love just listening to what Lonnie was saying is so inspiring. And I think you're right. It can apply to anybody. It doesn't matter what field or industry you want to get into or what you want to pivot to. Trusting the process and just believing and working hard will take you places that, you know, even your wildest imagination couldn't really foresee. And so for me, the big thing as well, just like Lonnie's, I had to pivot, right? And I remember when we went to the studio, the last time I was actually in studio was March, right? I think it was March 15th. And it was like, oh, we're just trying to figure it out. And I heard rumors that we'll be back in 2 weeks. And then all of a sudden, 2 weeks turned into like 9 months, right? Yep. It turned into the longest period. But somewhere around, I think it was like around the summer or in the spring, we started to say, okay, we're going to start remote streaming and filming at home. So the job that maybe 10 people did, I now had to do for myself at home. That means hair, makeup. That means setting up the set at home. Like, there's people,
lights,
that's their job. Lights, yeah.
Audio,
camera. My husband quickly had to be the shipping and receiving department, and he also had to be the production staff. So, you know, that was difficult. But I'm so grateful that I have him because it really made it a lot easier. I can't imagine how people are doing this on their own, especially when you're in a very dynamic situation where you're hosting a live show on a huge platform. Anything can happen. My tablet dies. My AirPods die. Like, anything can happen. So you always have to be nimble and flexible. So I think for me, I realized that this is all temporary. It's not going to be like this for very long. But I'm just really grateful to be working during a pandemic. I was listening to a podcast this morning, and they were talking about the fact that people are buying more goods. Approximately half the jobs have been recovered back into the economy. But a lot of the jobs that are going to suffer are like the service industry jobs. So it's really inspiring to hear these journeys. Like Lonnie's saying, I had to pivot. I'm doing my own thing. I'm working online. You know, is that we all have had to pivot and we've all have had to make changes. And I think that's the only way that we're truly going to bounce back once this thing is behind us, right? But in this moment, I think this is a great moment to be reflective. It definitely made me pause for a little bit and think about, where am I going in life? Am I happy with where I'm at? Career-wise, definitely happy. But again, I created this food project that you saw on my Instagram page from the pandemic. It was kind of like, okay, you have these jobs where you create content for other people, but what's the one thing that you're passionate about that you aren't doing that you should be doing? There's a couple of things that are on that list, but at the very top of that was like creating my own content, sharing my culture. And so for me, it's been a moment of like growth and reflection and just like, you know what? We're going to make it. Just take one day at a time. Every day presents us new challenges, but we're going to make it, and just really maintaining that sense of calm.
Amazing. Well, both of you are making me feel better about everything. Very optimistic and inspiring stories. I have one last question for both of you, and I will start with you, Mako. What does being a Black woman in entertainment mean to you? Kind of circling this back to the culture and the fact that we are, you know, spotlighting Black women in entertainment and food. I mean, what does it mean to you?
I mean, it means a lot. I think for me, it adds an interesting layer because, like I said, I was born in Zimbabwe. And the fact that my mom moved us here and really wanted us to create our own lives and really fulfill our dreams means that I really don't have the chance or the bandwidth or the opportunity to lose, right? It means that I put my all in everything because I realized that not only am I doing it for myself, because as you know, as we've talked about, I'm very passionate about all the things that I'm doing, but I also represent my mom. I represent my family. I represent people that are watching me back home. And I have this shot to really make something special and really fulfill my dream. So I'm not going to mess that up, you know? So I always carry that responsibility. And although it may feel like a sort of like a burden, it's actually not. It inspires me to work harder because I see how far I've come. So every year we actually go back home and it gives me just a chance to tap in and reconnect, you know, hear people speaking our language, eat the food there, reconnect with family members that I haven't seen in a long time, immerse myself in the local culture. And that's really important because that gives me the why, when I get back out into the world, it gives me the why I'm here and what my goal is to accomplish. But, you know, if people see me, they don't know that I'm African. They just see me as a Black woman. And I think being a Black woman is very, very interesting because you see all these protests and what's happening with George Floyd. And I think we are at a turning point as a country. But then there's still a lot more work that needs to be done, right? You understand that these conversations are just conversations. And, you know, without the actual work to change things, things won't change. So I'm very inspired by the young people that are coming up and, you know, really speaking out and challenging their parents. And I think they are the future. So I say all that to say that it's a very interesting place to be as a Black woman in entertainment. I understand that there is not a lot of us in this spot. And so my job is to just always represent us and represent us well, because I know that there are a lot of people that are watching.
Amazing. And then Lonnie, I have the same question for you, but instead of entertainment, it would be food. Well, I guess you're sort of entertainment too, but you know what I mean.
It's an interesting question. I mean, I think that, you know, I've said for the longest that Black women in the United States, because of our history and our sort of like, you know, social positioning or however you want to describe it, I think that we are very specifically poised to lead with a depth of compassion and empathy and a holistic view of what it means to be a human being. I think that we have a rich history in this country specifically as, you know, for me, the flavor of Black woman that I am, I come from people who got here through the transatlantic slave trade. Not every Black woman in the United States, that's their roots, that's their history, right? Like, not everyone shares that, but a lot of Black women here do. And, you know, those are my roots. And, you know, as you dive into that history, the richness of the things that are carried literally down through the DNA, the good and the bad. There's so much bad and there's so much good. And to be able to carry that with me through, you know, my ancestors' prayers and my connection to my family. I mean, I had the most beautiful opportunity this year to begin working on a short film around a documentary focusing on food sovereignty in the Deep South, because my people, you know, I have an uncle who farms and he feeds people, and he's been doing that since the beginning of the pandemic because, you know, in the rural South, people have been hit hard, and just seeing the beauty in that and understanding that that's a story that needs to be told, I think is a gift that is given to me by virtue of the Black female and femme experience in the United States. And I mean, you know, it feels like such an incredible blessing to be born a Black woman in the United States. And yeah, I mean, I don't know if that answers your question. Maybe
no, it does. No, that was, I knew you were going to have an amazing answer. So you did not disappoint at all. Well, both of you, that was so amazing, so inspiring, so informative. And for anybody listening, I hope you, you know, walk away from hearing these, you know, fantastic, inspiring women and, you know, kind of with a pep in your step and, you know, will to keep pushing with whatever you're pushing with, because clearly, you know, it can be done with the right amount of hard work and, you know, good intentions. And just, yeah, you guys, like I said, I'm so inspired by both of you and, you know, just amazed by everything that you have both been able to accomplish in your careers and as, you know, just people, just great, great human beings, which I'm very lucky and feel very blessed to know both of you. So very much so appreciate you.
Oh my God, this was so great. And wait, yes. While we're talking about inspirational Black women, I just have to add that this super inspirational Black woman, Kamala Harris, hope that as she is in the White House, since this is a food podcast, that we get to get some Jamaican food in there. We get some Indian, South Asian food. I can't wait until that happens in the White House. That was
yes. Yeah, that'll be like like how Michelle Obama, you know, had
yes.
gardening and, you know, fresh
yes.
food initiative. Kamala can get mm-hmm. us going with like some, you know, some Southern food and some Jamaican food. And
I want some Indian curry food. Goat. Give me some oxtail. Okay, make that happen. Let's get that going.
That'll be her first order of duty. Well, that was amazing. Thank you guys so much. I'm going to read the outro, but Jess, I totally realized that I forgot to read the commercial break thing. So I will do that right before. And I apologize that you'll have to edit that. But yeah, I think both of you, I'm good with you. Just stay on for a moment and I will read the commercial break thing and then the outro thing. And then we can jump off. So here we go. Okay. All right, everybody, we'll be right back. Try it again. All right, everybody, we'll be right back. We're going to take a quick break from our sponsors. And now the outro, Jess. Thank you so much for listening. To learn more about the food and drink discovery platform that is the FeedFeed, head to thefeedfeed.com. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at thefeedfeed, and please follow today's guests as well. If you have a food story to tell us or want us to interview a blogger, cookbook author, chef, or restaurateur about a specific country or region and its cuisine, we'd love your suggestions. Just send us a DM on Instagram. See you next time.
The FeedFeed is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.